Welcome, and thank you for listening to this recording, part of the Comprehensive Opioid Stimulant and Substance Abuse Program, or COSAP, podcast series. COSAP provides financial and technical assistance to states and units of local and Indian tribal governments to plan, develop, and implement comprehensive efforts to identify, respond to, treat, and support those impacted by the opioid epidemic. Since 2017, BJA has supported innovative work on these COSAP sites across the nation. Funding and programmatic support for COSAP is provided by the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance, or BJA. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us for episode 2. In this episode, we will be exploring partnerships with our guest speakers, Sadie Thompson of Wellbeing Initiative, Inc., and Rich Alexander of the Burlington County Prosecutor's Office.
So as we move to episode 2, which is partnerships, we're going to look more into what makes your program's locality unique. Both of you are in completely opposite sides of the country, so I think this is going to be wonderful to hear, especially as different PRSS programs look to implement things in their own communities. Rich, would you mind getting us started?
Sure. What makes Burlington County unique in New Jersey is it has a large rural community. It has also suburban communities. So much of New Jersey is very densely populated, yet in Burlington County, it's actually the only county in the state that goes from one side of the state to the other. So it goes from the Delaware River all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. Also, what's unique about Burlington County is that there's a light rail system that connects two of the cities that are on either side of Burlington County. One is Trenton, which is the state capital, and the other is Camden, which is the city which is directly across the river from Philadelphia. And the light rail system called the River Line brings with it some unique challenges when it comes to, you know, drug addiction and drug dealing. And so, you know, we have to deal with these different areas, which is one is connecting to larger cities and the other part of the county being part of the Pine Barrens, where, you know, houses are dispersed by miles even. So, you know, the barriers that this has created is it brings about unique issues. And one is in the Pine Barrens area that, you know, there's delays in response time to get a peer to reach there. And of course, we literally have one peer on call at a time. We do sometimes have a backup, yet no matter where we place this peer in the county, the call seemed to come to the other side of the county. So if we had someone placed in the Pine Barrens, their call would be all the way on the other side. But we could get there within 60 minutes, but we prefer to be there in 10 minutes. It's just fantastic situation where, you know, an officer calls and in 10 or 15 minutes, someone is standing right there helping this person. It's great for the officer and it's great for, you know, the person who's looking for services. And then, you know, the river line that I spoke to about the light rail service between Camden and Trenton, we've done outreach on the river line where we give out flyers, letting them know what services are available. And I've been on there with law enforcement officers. I've been on there with the county prosecutor. And we learned that people are very smart and understand what's going on. And so when I was with the prosecutor at the time, one of the people, you know, they were pushing back on us and they were saying that you get people and you can get them to detox. And then when they come home, they go to the same neighborhood or they have no transportation. We need housing. We need more help than just going to detox. And it's true. And at the time our hands were tied and now we do have transportation, you know, to get people to services. And now, you know, we heard the questions about, we have access to sober living, yet we find that many people, they don't want to go to sober living. They want their own apartment. And at this point, we just can't offer that. But I understand the thinking there. And we've been there with our Hope One van. They'll park it at a station in a town. And we start talking to people. And one thing I didn't expect, which I guess is really not a barrier, but one thing I did learn while we were working with people coming off on and off the river line is that there's people in recovery. You know, I start talking to someone, they're like, oh yeah, I'm in recovery. I'm going to Camden to the such and such treatment facility, or I'm doing outpatient. So it was great to see that too when we were out there.
Absolutely. And so I know you all are very close-knit with your law enforcement agency in that area, but how were you able to get that buy-in from them?
I've worked in many different organizations as a project manager, and ideally it always comes from the top down. And that's how we get buy-in. When someone's boss is telling them to buy in, they will start to buy in. Or they may not, but more people will buy in. And so luckily for us, you know, in Burlington County, when I joined the team, we had the prosecutor, who is the highest ranking law enforcement official in the county. This was his program. These were his ideas. And then he had hired an assistant prosecutor who's someone in recovery. And so that's a buy-in. I've had people ask me, what if you ran this in another county? I was like, well, I'm at an advantage having a prosecutor that's in recovery, you know, who's been to treatment or been to meetings or learned how the interactions go with law enforcement. So we have a unique buy-in. And then also, but we learned that we set up the straight to treatment, and I'm starting talking to an officer, and then the officer tells me they're in recovery. And then all of a sudden, this is one of our, you know, these are our advocates. And these are the people who can really make a difference and who are willing to go the extra mile. And that's one of our great things about partnering with people. The more you're involved, the more you find that there are advocates out there. We've had law enforcement officers that have lost family members to addiction, and they are willing to do whatever it takes to make sure that people are connected to services. And that could have them, you know, waiting around, and officers are busy, they're understaffed at police departments, like everywhere else is understaffed thanks to COVID. And they'll take the extra time to make sure this happens and make sure that people are getting the services they need. So I feel very lucky as a leader when I have the buy-in of the leaders of the organization, because at the time when there was a meeting with what I understand about the inner workings of law enforcement are very limited, but I understand that, you know, there's a monthly chief's meeting where every chief from the 42 municipalities across the county get together with the prosecutor and the chief of chiefs. And when you have that being brought up every time they have a meeting and asking, you know, to remind officers to refer to Operation Helping Hand, that really makes the program that much more important to everyone involved.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you guys have incredible trust with your officers in that community. Would you have any advice for programs who are looking to partner with their local law enforcement agency?
Yeah, I think in line with what I just said, you know, I would suggest finding those law enforcement officers that are already supporting these types of programs and go out and meet them. We've even met a deputy mayor in one of our towns. We didn't know that she was in recovery for 30 years. You can really get buy-in, you know, when people in the town in leadership positions are supporting you. These are the people to start with. And then with any project, you know, depending on the funding available, you know, it's really to start slow and grow an impactful program instead of trying to launch a statewide program all at once, covering all intercepts, you know, as soon as possible. Now, I would love to, you know, with millions and millions of dollars, but we're not in that kind of scenario where the funding is unlimited. So what we've learned is when we look closely at the funds we get and we look to have the greatest impact we can have with that money, instead of watering it down and being more of a showpiece than something that's having an impact. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I have a master's degree in business administration. And so, you know, I've worked on change management, you know, initiatives, and change management is a great tool. And like for me, I've worked in change management initiatives for 2 years. So I start looking at everything as a change management like a teaching moment. You know, you can't expect to train law enforcement officers and have them running programs the next day or the week or the month. When you're working with law enforcement that don't understand issues, you know, it's our job to train them. And it's our clinical supervisor is always reminding us when we have group supervision with our peer recovery specialists that every time you talk to an officer, it's a teaching moment for them. And law enforcement has told us that. I remember one of the sergeants that works closely with our program that in the beginning, you know, he's like, listen, Rich, when an officer calls you, that means that they really want this to happen. They are not, there's no directive that says they have to call every time they run into someone who has an issue with alcohol or drugs. When they call, they're for what you're doing. And so what we learned is we can take a teaching moment. If someone says they never heard of the program, so as change management, if someone isn't aware of the program, then we make them aware and we let them know right there what we offer and what number to call us on. And then if an officer calls us 6 hours after someone had an incident, it's another training moment because we can have a peer recovery specialist get upset. Why did they wait so long? Why didn't they call us immediately? Now we can't find this person. And then again, the clinical supervisor lets us know this is a training moment. So when they call, like, we're very appreciative of every call, even if we don't get the result we want. We want the officer to know to call again. And so we let them know that if possible, call us immediately because we lose people even after 2 and 3 hours. We won't find them. And if we're lucky to see them in weeks again or months. Don't get caught up with those that don't understand the issues. Have those that understand help and grow your program.
That is such a great perspective, and I think a wonderful teaching moment for all of our listeners as well. So I appreciate that, Rich. Sadie, would you talk to me about what makes your program locality unique?
So we are in Nebraska, and we're in Lincoln and also across the whole state. So Nebraska is a primarily rural and frontier state. It's pretty large in comparison to like New Jersey, and it has 4 metropolitan, and that's being generous, calling them metropolitan areas. 2 of the 4, I think, are sitting around 40,000 people, mostly very rural. And it's also a really conservative state for the most part. And so generally, the view on things like harm reduction or techniques for harm reduction tools, medication for opioid use disorder or medication for substance use disorder treatment, that kind of thing is very much burgeoning, not necessarily the norm. We only have, I think, 3 medication for opioid use disorder treatment providers in Nebraska. It could be 4, but I think it's 3. And so that's like very, very small for such a broad landscape. And so we do have struggles with staffing shortages in corrections specifically. I think our state prison and correction system, like the most highly staffed facilities are at 60% staffed. And that's like the very, very best, most highly staffed facilities are only at 60%. So we have massive staffing shortages. Fentanyl has hit Nebraska. And we also have a large population of people that use methamphetamines. And Nebraska has a huge binge drinking culture too, just with university football, and it's kind of just the norm here. So that's kind of the general landscape of substance use and corrections here. One of the cool things, I guess, that come out of those is that because there is such shortages within corrections, there has been more open-mindedness from correctional facilities around the use of peer support. One of the other peer support organizations here in Nebraska too has done a really, really great job partnering historically with police and the prisons for mental health peer support. And so that's been a great connector too. But we recently were able to be keynote speakers actually at the NCAMA, that's Nebraska Correctional Administrators and Managers Association conference, where we got to talk about the use of peer support within the correction system and within county jails. And so there was nearly every county jail administrator in one place at one time getting to hear about the cost benefits of peer support for them, also the benefits to their current staff because they're experiencing such great burnout, and how peer support can alleviate a lot of the stress and tension for corrections facilities when you're not having to be both a corrections officer and moral support for people incarcerated. That's kind of compete with one another, and it's not what they're trained for. Similarly, it's not what police are trained for, to be social workers, like Rich was saying. And so I think our different communities of police are really grateful to have a different resource to provide individuals than them being the ones that are coming back to this person's house or taking this person to jail over and over. They have somebody that's actually been there and can talk to people and can kind of, you know, mitigate some of the recidivism that they're seeing. And so when we talk about getting buy-in, I think from our state's perspective, you do have to be able to point at how it's fiscally responsible to employ and utilize peer support. And so as an organization, we're working really hard to collect and aggregate data around the cost benefit for peer support in all of these different scenarios. But when we talk about the use of it and how it can support just turnover within the county jails, that in and of itself might be worth the investment to get on board and to either financially contribute towards having more peers or to just be on board and partnering and communicating with the peers that your program offers.
Yeah, so it sounds like a really difficult situation turned out to have a wonderful silver lining.
Yes, and I think that it's still a work in progress. It's not necessarily that everyone's bought into peer support works, but I think that people are bought into what we're doing doesn't work.
Absolutely. And so if I understand you correctly, when you're talking about working with correction officers, not only offering peer support to the inmates that are there, but is that also peer support to the actual officers, teaching them those skills as well?
Yes. So that is a dream of ours, is to be able to do that, because I really think that that could change the game. But I think the way it benefits corrections officers is that some of the responsibility that they've kind of had to take on, because when we talk about small county jails in Nebraska, we're talking about there's three employees. And when there's three employees, everyone's burnout because they're doing everything. And just having someone to do kind of the emotional heavy lifting takes a lot off of their plate and allows them to focus more on either the administrative or the logistical pieces of their job.
I think that that is kind of one of those up and coming focus areas, the corrections aspect that we're kind of seeing peer support move into. And it's really exciting to see it happen.
Absolutely.
So would you have any advice for PRSS programs who are looking to partner? Rich and yourself both have very unique ways that your organizations work with law enforcement. So what would you say would be a piece of advice that you have for someone?
Collecting as much data as you can and being able to demonstrate any type of cost benefit, I think, is extremely helpful. Also, making sure that when you're having conversations with individual departments or corrections facilities that you're acknowledging the hard work that they do, because I think it goes unnoticed and unrecognized. And so we've had really good luck making sure that we're identifying, you know, the important things that corrections officers or police are doing for our community and the things that they're being asked to do that are really outside their scope and how peer support can alleviate that. I would say being well prepared and having your ducks in a row, have data, have numbers, have cost benefit ready, and make sure that you show appreciation for all the work that they're doing, because they don't get that enough.
Great advice. Thank you. I think that will be incredibly helpful as we have organizations who hopefully listen to this and look for ways to implement that across their own community. So thank you both so much. I think that was a really, really great conversation about community buy-in and partner buy-in and making that implemented across your community. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about how COSAP is supporting communities across the nation, visit us at www.cosapresources.org. We also welcome your email at cosap@iir.com.